from the McGill Daily and CKUT. This is Unfit to Print. Hello, you're listening to Unfit to Print, the McGill Daily's radio show. I'm Naomi Endicott, and I'll be your host this week. This week in the Daily, Matthew Castle explores the teaching of jazz at the post-secondary level and the options available for those who study it. In news, McGill's new enrollment plan is set to change recruitment priorities and deregulate international tuition rates. And we have two retrospective articles looking back on Expo 67 and its lingering effects on the city and features, and the Human Genome Project 10 years after its completion in SciTech. That's the January 24th issue on stands now. Also this week, we relaunched our website, mcgilldaily.com. After a few teething problems with too much traffic, it's up and running with a beautiful new layout and snazzier features, all thanks to Mathieu in our business office and Tom, our web editor. Last week, Erin Hudson spoke with McGill professor Khalid Medani ahead of the referendum that happened in Sudan on January 9th. As the culmination of the comprehensive peace agreement that ended Sudan's civil war in 2005, the referendum for southern self-determination resulted in 98.8% voting in favour of an independent South Sudan, according to preliminary results as of January 23rd. In light of these preliminary results, President Omar al-Bashir has announced that the North will accept the results, and southern Sudan is expected to declare independence later this year. The last remaining votes are still being counted, and official results will be announced mid-February. Khalid M. Medani is Associate Professor of Political Science and Islamic Studies at McGill, and he travels frequently to Sudan. In a horse's mouth printed on January 10th, he discussed his views on the vote, tensions between Arab and African identities, and the role of the international community in the referendum. Here is some of the content that didn't make it into print.
Many, although not officially, many southerners are saying, well, we'll declare independence even if the referendum doesn't occur, which would immediately mean that the country will go back to war. And there's no question about that. I mean, it's getting to be that tense. There are many people in the north who want the south to separate. I was talking to young people your age, you know, college students. And I have to be honest, we had very stimulating discussions and arguments, but I suppose I disagreed with them. But they, many of them, middle class, of course, you know how college students are, and very educated, and they felt that they would tell me, well, professor, we want them to leave. You know, they're a different culture, and if they don't want to be part of us, that's fine. Anyway, we're Muslims and Arabs, and you know, over these many years, we haven't been able to bridge that. And there's increasingly a heightened sense of being a Muslim and being an Arab. Believe it or not, that wasn't necessarily the case when I was growing up. So I think it's a result of not only this government, but also the wars themselves and the division between the North and the South. But I have to say that I would still say that the majority across the spectrum, if you take in general, different age groups, and I spoke to many people, they feel that it's going to be very dangerous. I mean, number one, there's a great deal of sadness, like on a cultural level, but they feel that it's going to disrupt the economy for the whole country, and especially the north, because the oil is in the north, in the south. Right. So there is that notion of real undermining it.
You mentioned the diversity of the Sudanese population. Could you talk a little bit about how there's an Arab identity, an African identity, and then being a northerner, being a southerner, like sort of What do all these different identities mean to people? Like, can you have multiple identities at the same time?
Yeah, no, I think you can definitely have multiple identities at the same time. I mean, at the local level and in interpersonal relations, like all cultures, people consider themselves at the lowest level of the culture. In other words, they identify by clan. And then in larger communities or in larger associations with other people, they may identify themselves as Arabs, and Africans. So, I mean, I think that their political designation of Arab and African is what you should keep in mind. I mean, I think when people talk about Arabs in Sudan or Africans, they're talking about politics. But at the level of the individual, people, like all people, consider themselves from multiple identities. And that has to do with the fact that identities and culture are constructed. What I mean by construction is that it changes over time, believe it or not, and also it's multiple. You can be, most people are, you know, adhere to multiple identities simultaneously. Africans especially do, and that is corroborated by research. As one anthropologist put it, Africans can't afford to have one identity because we go through a lot of conflict and poverty and lots of issues. Having one identity doesn't secure you political safety, economic safety. You have to be able to be flexible. And so from Sudanese, they consider themselves a clan identity, tribe identity, Africans, Arabs, all of that. And that's something that is very important to keep in mind. So it's very, very fluid. Now it's the politicians. You know, it's the politicians who decide, let's use the Arab identity, and this is what we call political entrepreneurship, in order to promote a particular ideology.
And well, I guess going to back to the Comprehensive Peace Agreement in 2005, since there were elections in 2009 and then the upcoming referendum, do you think the agreement achieved its objectives? And
I don't think that the CPA, the agreement, achieved its objective in the spirit of the law. I think that it's achieving its objectives in the technical aspects of the agreement. It is achieved the objective of a ceasefire and a peace agreement between the North and the South. It has achieved its objective of technically splitting the oil wealth 50-50 to the North and the South. And it's achieved the so-called, holding of elections that were not elections at all. The real spirit of it was to make unity attractive, in quotations, to Southerners. And that required the holding of truly democratic elections. But as you know, with the elections last year, most of the political parties actually, you know, boycotted. So in that sense, it has not achieved it at all. And one of the most important flaws of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement is that it did not understand the real problem of the Sudan. It envisioned the problem as being a civil war between the North as a bloc and the Northerners as a bloc. The problem in Sudan is between a centralized government that's unrepresentative and many other groups, subnational groups, who are also aggrieved, even if the referendum goes through, hopefully it will, the future of stability and the absence of conflict will depend on understanding this conflict and the Sudan in a new way. So the international community has to understand that, okay, it's important for the referendum to go through, but it's also important to put diplomatic and other pressures on both parties to make sure that they become more representative.
One question I had was, I know that China and the U.S. both were involved in Sudan with the oil.
Yeah.
So considering sort of tension between U.S. and China, would that issue sort of spill into Sudan and affect the referendum or the aftermath of the referendum in any way that you might be able to see at this point at least?
The truth is the Americans and Chinese are very careful not to go head-to-head. But they're, you know, what is going on with them in Sudan is what is going on with them globally. And it's a fierce economic competition. It's no secret that, China wants that oil and needs it. I think from the Chinese perspective, they feel that the Europeans and Americans not only have access to Gulf oil, but they also have strategic and military, power over the sources of the oil and energy in the Gulf and in the Middle East. And so they feel they have every right, obviously, to seek energy elsewhere. I don't think the Americans publicly have ever had anything to say against that, except, of course, to criticize them for not dealing effectively with the human rights violations in Darfur. I think that there is no secret that not only American oil companies, corporations, but also European ones are very interested in energy resources in Sudan, in the south, and in general. And the fight for concessions is very competitive. Right now, you have China has the control and over most of the oil, but because there is a chance that there may be oil throughout the parts of other country, there is a real competitiveness among, frankly, more Europeans than Americans. Europeans really are interested in new oil development.
Of Unfit to Print with the McGill Daily and CKUT. We'll be back soon, and in the meantime, look out for our annual art issue on Stands Thursday.